This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are few criminal justice issues more controversial or emotional than what to do with convicted child molesters after they've served their time. Well-known cases of abduction, rape, and murder led all 50 states and the federal government to pass laws designed to protect children. On release from prison, sex offenders must register their name, address, and photograph, and that information is posted in online registries. Many states and local governments also passed laws that bar sex offenders from living near places where children gather, like schools and playgrounds. A new report from Human Rights Watch concludes that these laws may seem intuitively correct, but that they're based on faulty ideas and do little, if anything, to protect children. They're also written so broadly, the report says, that they include many people who pose no threat to kids at all and expose them to ridicule, hatred, and sometimes violence. Later in the program, another emotional issue as O.J. Simpson faces new charges, but first, sex offenders and the law. Do you use online registries to see if sex offenders live in your neighborhood? If so, what do you do with that information? And if you're an ex-offender, how do these laws affect you? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also get in touch with us by email, talk@npr.org, or join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Sarah Tofte is a researcher at Human Rights Watch and co-author of the report, No Easy Answers, Sex Offender Laws in the United States. She joins us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Human Rights Watch usually deals with refugees, political prisoners, that sort of thing. Why sex offenders?
Well, a few years ago, we were doing a report on public housing and access to public housing for all former offenders. And in the process of that research, we started collecting stories of former sex offenders who are having a particularly hard time reentering the community. And so we started to investigate. And what we found along the way was, you know, not just that the laws that you mentioned, the registration, community notification, residency restriction laws have a pretty severe impact on former sex offenders. The laws, there's very little evidence that they are actually preventing sexual violence, and there is some evidence that they may be doing more harm than good. And we felt like that was a very important report for us to release.
Mm-hmm. More harm than good? How?
Well, these laws, as you mentioned before, are based on some myths that we have about convicted sex offenders, myths that I had myself before I started doing the research, that previously convicted sex offenders pose sort of the greatest danger towards our children in terms of sexual violence, and that, you know, previously convicted sex offenders have a really high recidivism rate. What I found while I was researching this report is that 87% of sex crimes every year are committed by individuals who have no previous sex crimes convictions. And 3 out of 4 sex offenders, convicted sex offenders, do not reoffend within sort of a 15-year period upon release from prison. So while there may be previously convicted sex offenders who pose some risk to the community and we want them to be monitored and maybe we want them to be subject to some form of these laws, there are, by focusing all of our attention only on previously convicted sex offenders, we're really ignoring sort of the larger picture of sexual violence in this country, which is that, again, most sex crimes every year are not committed by someone who has a sex crime conviction. And another important point or part of this is that most sex crimes, over 90% of sexual abuse against children is committed by someone that child knows or trusts or love. And so stranger danger isn't it's part of the problem, but it's not as big a part of the problem as I think is widely believed. And so, again, when we focus all of our attention on previously convicted sex offenders, we're not able to really focus the public resources and have the public debate we need to be having about the real picture of sexual violence in this country and what we can do to prevent it and what we can do to make sure that there are no more victims.
You also write that these registries it's very difficult to get off once you're on. In some cases, you're on for life.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when we started in 1994, the Jacob Wetterling Act was the first federal law that dealt with sex offender registration. And that required sexually violent offenders to register for a period of 10 years. That's where we started. Where we are today is you're expanding the scope of the registry in the sense that you have a number of individuals on there who committed nonviolent offenses like public urination or consensual teenage sex. And you also increasingly states are moving and federal laws moving to require lifetime registration without the ability to petition to get off, regardless of how long you've lived in the community offense-free or any evidence you might present of rehabilitation. And why this matters, it matters for a number of reasons. You know, there is a lot of harsh consequences for former offenders. But at the same time, what you do is if you have a registry then that is not limited to individuals that have been individually assessed to actually pose a risk to the community, then you are diluting the meaning or the meaningfulness of the information that parents want or think they're getting from these online registries because you just have so many individuals on the registry that it makes it very difficult for law enforcement to keep track of all of them. And again, there are a number of individuals on there who really never needed to be on there in the first place, either because they committed a crime that we tend not to think of as a sex crime, again, like having consensual teenage sex, or who just never pose much of a risk to the community. So you've got these overbroad and overlong registration requirements. And again, what you're diluting then is any public safety impact they could have because mm-hmm. you just have too much information on the registries and it's not meaningful.
One of the purposes of these lists, in fact, is if a sex crime is committed, the police can use these lists to, look for, I guess, the usual suspects.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, in our report, in our recommendations, we support police registration. We're not clear exactly how police are using the registries, but we do think it's important that police can have a list of names who they, you know, and if they, but we also really want states to actually create laws that are more narrowly tailored and, again, more meaningful because if you just have a list of names for police that just has everyone's name who's ever committed a sex crime on there, law enforcement's going to be overwhelmed. It's going to dilute their ability to monitor those offenders who need monitoring in the community. There has to be more discernment in the way in which we apply sex offender laws to individuals.
We're talking with Sarah Tofte of Human Rights Watch, co-author of the report No Easy Answers, Sex Offender Laws in the United States. Do you use these online registries? What do you do with the information? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's start with Renee. Renee's with us from Olean in New York.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I wanted to say I do use the sex offender registries. I use them for a couple reasons, but first and foremost to make sure my children are protected in my neighborhood. Do I go out and harass these people? No. Do I say anything to them when they walk down the street? No. Do I inform my 10-year-old that that person is not a nice person and do not speak to them? I most certainly do.
Mm-hmm. Because you're obviously worried what might happen.
Exactly. I would rather have my child slightly afraid of someone than the alternative, mm-hmm. the worst scenario. I don't think, first of all, there's only level 3 sex offenders registered on these. So it's not every little groping and feeling in the park and every offender. These are the dangerous ones. An informed person, when they're looking at these, you can read what their crime was. And if it's an 18-year-old male and it was sex with a 16-year-old, I don't think that's a crime if there's two high school students that consented. If there's a 45-year-old man and a 13-year-old girl, whether it was consensual or not, that's a crime.
Does the
he forced her? He's too old.
No, I understand. Does the registry go into that level of detail?
Most of them do. I'm on this on a regular basis because also for my job, I have to go to people's homes, so I always check and make sure that there's not a violent offender before I go to their home because mm-hmm. I'm usually by myself. So most of them, I'd say 90% of them, list what their crime was to a teeny bit extent. They don't give details. You can tell if it was a violent or coerced crime. If you look at the very bottom of most of the registries, it says, was there coercion used? Was there a weapon used? Was this person known to the offender? As a general rule, their crime is listed like rape in the first or sodomy or whatever, and it says with a child younger than 15, with a child younger than 12. It lists the date of their offense. I mean, if you put two and two together and see that they were 18 and the child was 16, then you can almost pretty much figure out. I think that if you are using this registry and you're using it as an informed citizen for a reasonable reason, it's not hard to deduce what their crime was. And I, honestly, to be perfectly honest, I don't feel bad for the ones that get harassed. If they commit such a heinous crime, I would never do that. But, you know, I mean, you're out there. That's your scarlet letter to wear if you want to do something so heinous. As far as I'm concerned, that's your scarlet letter.
Renee, thanks very much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sarah Tofte, she raises a couple of good points, one of which is she seems to be using it in a reasonable fashion, and the other which is sex offenders get very little sympathy.
Yes. Well, you know, I think, yeah, Renee brings up a number of good points, and I think which is why these laws are so popular. They're very popular. And for us, just because they're popular doesn't necessarily make them good public policy. But we do know that, you know, family members, all of us, we want to protect the children that we love. And parents will do whatever they can, you know, to do that and get as much information as they can to be able to do that. You know, when Renee speaks about the limited the online registry and the way it's sort of more narrowly tailored in New York. Unfortunately, you know, we researched this pretty extensively and we looked at every state's online registry and read the laws to figure out who would qualify to be on the registry. Most state registries actually don't do that kind of they don't narrowly tailor who's placed online. They typically put anyone who's registered as an offender online. And again, the information is not as meaningful as it could be. When they talk about the crime the individual committed, they often just list the statute under which they were convicted, which
can be
tells
pretty vague.
You a little bit, but can be very vague.
All right. We'll be back with more, including we'll talk with a founder of an online sex offender registry to see what he thinks of the Human Rights Report. Stay with us. Give us a call if you're interested, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little later, we'll get to the O.J. Simpson saga. But right now, we're talking about the effectiveness of online sex offender registries and other laws about sex offenders, how parents and neighbors deal with the information they find. Our guest is Sarah Tofte, a researcher at Human Rights Watch, co-author of the report No Easy Answers, Sex Offender Laws in the U.S. And we want to hear from you. Do you use these online registries to see if sex offenders live in your neighborhood? If so, what do you do with that information? Also, if you're an ex-offender, how do these laws affect you? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Steve Roddle. He's the founder of FamilyWatchOut.us, an online sex offender registry. He joins us from his office in Indianapolis. Very good of you to be with us today.
Oh, thanks a lot, Neil. Glad to be here.
And I know you've had a chance to at least look at much of the Human Rights Report Watch. What do you think of it?
You know, I mean, unfortunately, there's just not a lot of it that we hold as high regard. You know, it starts with the premise that the sex offender registry is only valuable for stranger danger. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that could be further from the truth. The sex offender registries tell you about who is in your acquaintance sphere, who you know. With FamilyWatchdog.us, I mean, we have had millions of visitors over the past 2 years since we've been operating that have come out, have looked for offenders. We've had literally tens of thousands of reports from people that have told us, you know, everything from I found my neighbor to I found my babysitter to I found a close family friend, I found a close family member. In some shocking cases, I found my husband, my boyfriend. One case was a stepson where a 17-year-old kid had been convicted of molesting a man's second wife's 9- and 10-year-old daughters, and man marries this woman. She has twin 10-year-olds. the guy never told her that, that his son was a registered sex offender.
Mm-hmm. So
and brought him into the home.
So you find these the registry useful, valuable information.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it's useful. You know, I would agree with Sarah that it has limited value from a standpoint of being able to prevent crime from strangers, but that's not really what we're targeting. We're trying to target people that you know.
Mm-hmm. And what about the allegation that the net is cast so wide that it picks up a lot of people, perhaps unfairly, who represent no threat whatsoever, the so-called Romeo and Juliets, the teenage kids?
Well, I think that you know, there's a couple things there. First, in the report, you know, what's spelled out clearly is that you know, in 3 years, only 5% of sex offenders are rearrested. What it doesn't say is that when you do long-term studies, that anywhere between 35 to 50+% of sex offenders are rearrested, reconvicted. You know, so there's a much longer term. When you look at that population long-term, you see very, very large numbers. You know, there are definitely people that do not belong on a sex offender registry. There are people who do things that what they do should not be a crime. I mean, you know, the Romeo and Juliet situations, we would be really, really happy to not have those people on registry. You know, Sarah brings up the public urination and you know, the report speaks to that 5 or 6 times, but the truth is, just because they can doesn't mean that they do. And what I mean by that is, we've gone through, and by the way, part of our business is that we capture all this data from the states on a daily basis. So we've got a database of sex offenders that goes back 2 years that we're able to call on and look through and just do statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about things like public urination, we found a potential population of 433 out of roughly 150,000 sex offenders in the 13 states that are referenced in the report. We shouldn't even have a conversation about that.
Steve Roddle, let me just stop you for a second. Sarah Tofte, he's challenging your recidivism statistics, which are a lot of your argument.
Exactly. You know, recidivism, you know, I do agree with Steve on a few things. One, it is difficult to measure recidivism. We do know that sex crimes are some of the most underreported crimes. We do also know that, you know, recidivism, we're measuring it by rearrest or reconviction rate. States and the federal government, sometimes they do it differently depending on the study. And that's the best sort of verifiable data we have out there. And, you know, the most authoritative study that most experts who I spoke with will cite is a study that looked at over 30,000 previously convicted sex offenders, individuals convicted of sexually violent offenses. Now, depending on your offense category, the recidivism rate can fluctuate. Overall, 3 out of 4 offenders are not rearrested or reconvicted for a sex crime. But there are certain categories, for example, adult men who molest pre-adolescent boys who have maybe closer to what Steve was saying, a 35% to 40% recidivism rate. But I do want to say, you know, we do understand that parents want information about who may be previously convicted sex offenders who might pose a risk to their children. And so Steve was talking about looking up on the registry to find out if the babysitter has a sex mm-hmm. crime conviction. And, you know, for us, you know, first of all, what we'd like to say is that, you know, states have to really narrowly tailor these laws. If they're going to have online notification, if they're going to do registration, they really need to make sure that the individuals that are on the registry pose some sort of risk to the community, and they have to figure out a way to do better targeted need-to-know sort of notification systems. You know, law enforcement has to have – states need to pass better laws mandating law enforcement community notification, again, done in a very targeted way. Mm-hmm. And for parents that want information about those that are living in their community, who their children are likely to come into contact with, then we think good community notification done by law enforcement officials will give them the information they want from the online registries.
Would you trust the police to give you that information in a timely manner? The police are like any other bureaucracy. They're
exactly.
Sometimes highly inefficient.
Understandable,
and
we have to start. But you know, we have to start again. I say crafting better the laws. The laws out there right now are not doing what they should be able to do. And we have to have more meaningful community notification laws. And you know, one of the reasons why we have why online notification is so difficult is because it really has such a severe impact on the former offenders.
And
that
let
are
me ask
online.
Steve Rottle about that. Is there any way for anybody to get off your registry?
Well, there are plenty of ways. I mean, not every state has every category of offender as a lifetime registrant. There are states here in my own state of Indiana, we have 10-year, we have 15-year registrants, we have lifetime registrants.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends really on the type of crime that they commit. I do want to say something on the police notification. I mean, the last thing that I believe that we as citizens of the United States are entitled to is to have the police come whisper in our ear. You know, I've been contacted a number of times, and most recently about a situation where in Alabama they had one of the highest level of offenders, most predatory offenders, had lived in a neighborhood for 6 months before the state had made a determination to do a community notification. And when they finally did that notification, the guy had been moved out for 4 months. People that had gone to familywatchdog.us, that had signed up for our free notifications, that had used our free service, knew the day that he moved in that he was there.
Here's an email we have from Ron in Jackson, Michigan. I'm a registered sex offender. I'm also an attorney, was elected president of my county bar association after my conviction, which was a misdemeanor. Your first caller is simply wrong, which she was calling from New York State. Each offender is not a level 3 offender. Michigan, for instance, does not differentiate among offenders, so urinating in public is the same as violent rape. My conviction was for a misdemeanor. I will stay on the registry until I am in my 70s. The list lulls people into a false sense of security and gives an easy target for those on it. Luckily, my community embraces me and supports me. Others are not so lucky. I wonder, Steve Rottle, do you worry that sometimes the information you have might be used to harass or even rough somebody up?
You know, I can tell you honestly, Neil, that in over 2 years of doing this, we have never gotten a report from anyone that our information has been used to cause any harassment or any harm to any sex offender.
Could I say
ahead,
something?
Sarah,
you know,
and,
for our
quickly, because we want to move on, give some listeners a chance.
Of course, you know, in our report, we interviewed over 200 former offenders, and for them, sadly, the stories were very similar. Once they're placed on an online registry, that information is just out there for anyone with an internet connection, regardless of whether they need to know it or not. And unfortunately, that information gets used to drive people from employment, to drive them from their housing, to drive them out of communities. And the reason why it's really important that we help people, former offenders, re-enter into the community successfully is because when they re-enter successfully, that means no more re-offending. And when there's no more re-offending, there's no more victims. And again, that's what we all want. And so it matters, you know, the severe consequences of being placed on these online registries. It matters for all of us and for our concern about protecting our children and about public safety.
Mm-hmm. Steve Rottle, the consequences of winding up on those directories, directories like yours, are considerable. Presumably, the original offense is reason enough for you to put them on.
Well, you know, we look at it like this, Neil, that it's up to the states to decide who should be on registry and who should not. I mean, we don't take that role, and we have actually worked with state legislatures to address the Romeo and Juliet situations, for example,
right.
Because we want those people off registry. We don't want them clogging up the criminal justice system. You know, but honestly, you know, I mean, talking to 200 sex offenders, you know, put things into perspective, you know, doing the math, you're going to have 3 million people this year in the United States that are sexually assaulted. You know, and I mean, we could talk about recidivism, which really means nothing because recidivism is not reoffense. It's many, many layers back from the offenders who go on to commit crimes again. You know, we are all for states trying to figure out how to limit the number of just no risk people and get them off these registries. Right. But I mean, you know, one of the case studies that was referenced was a guy who was convicted of streaking is on a Pennsylvania registry. Well, Pennsylvania doesn't require registration for streaking. Mm. So, you know, it makes no sense, you know, how you could include somebody in a report for something that's not a crime in that state.
All right, Steve Rottle, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
Steve Rottle is the founder of FamilyWatchdog.us, an online sex offender registry, with us today from his office in Indianapolis, Indiana, indeed. We're also talking with Sarah Tofte of Human Rights Watch, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get Kevin on the line. Kevin's calling us from Detroit, Michigan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a registered sex offender, and I pled no contest to a misdemeanor. There's four levels of criminal sexual conduct in Michigan, and the only one that's a misdemeanor is fourth degree.
Right.
I had it expunged some years later. I've never had a brush with the law on any level. And I have no criminal record yet. I'm still compelled to the guidelines of the PSOR, the Public Sex Offender Registry.
And so, and how long will you be on that?
I'll be on it for about another 15 years. I've been on it about 10.
And there's no way to get off?
There's no way to get off. And it's, you know, there's nobody's going to cut this group of guys a break. Nobody's, you know, going to stick up for these guys. So it's refreshing to hear this on your program. Because it could be a useful tool. It could serve the community, a registry. But
And how has it affected your life to be on this registry?
It's, you know, it's affected my life deeply and daily. I have three children, my oldest. You know, it's just been very difficult. Friends have come to them with this information. It didn't come with an owner's manual. You know, I basically... you know, I was put on this, and I had to parent my way through everything that came up. My marriage has since failed. You know, it's been very stressful on us. I've had bosses or coworkers who have, you know, really eroded away at my self-confidence and by continually harassing me with this. And because you're on the internet, it's this. You know, it's never going away. It's, and people have the perception, I think, that if it's on the internet, it's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they think that if you're on this registry, then, you know, you're just moments away from grabbing their young children and running off to the woods of, you know, Utah or something. It's just, it's tremendously stressful. It's cost me a great personal toll, and it's really hard.
Kevin, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. I know that's not easy.
Sir.
Yeah. Thanks very much. I'm sure you're aware, Sarah Tofte, that in presenting this report, clearly there are cases like Kevin's, which, as he describes it, seems excessive. And there are the other kinds of cases which seem excessive, but still a mistake in this regard to find that your next-door neighbor is a dangerous person, that's important information for people to know.
Yeah. Again, we understand that parents want to know this information, and parents want to do whatever they can do to protect their children from sexual violence. One, we're concerned that by focusing almost all of our public attention and the public debate on previously convicted sex offenders, again, we are not looking at the larger picture of sexual violence and the fact that the majority of sex crimes are not committed by previously convicted sex offenders, and it's happening within the home. That's a discussion that we have not had. We don't talk a whole lot about in the media. Legislators don't talk a whole lot about that picture of sexual violence. But, you know, for us, that's why in our recommendations, we were very careful with our recommendations because, again, we understand that the desire to know and to protect your children from people who may be a danger to them. And so that's information, you know, when you have police registries, you can go down to the police station and get that information. Or if states are going to have community notification, they have to do more carefully targeted law enforcement notification, and they have to do, if they're going to do online registries, you know, they really need to restrict it to those that have been individually assessed to pose a risk, and they have to format in a way that actually gives parents the information they want, because I've actually spoken to a number of parents who say they go on their state's online registry and they're overwhelmed with the information. There are thousands of entries, and again, there's very little information about what you should actually do with that information and how, once you've known, now that you have the information, how you protect your child. So I think parents want meaningful information, and at the same time, parents want a safe society. And like we said before, when sex offenders and former offenders are allowed to reintegrate into the community, and they have stable housing and stable employment, and they're not dealing with harassment, they're less likely to reoffend. And again, that makes us all safer, and that is the goal I think that everyone shares.
Sarah Tofte, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Tofte, researcher of Human Rights Watch and co-author of the report No Easy Answers, Sex Offender Laws in the United States. Stay with us. We'll talk about more about who these offenders are, and then we'll get to that O.J. Simpson story. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In just a few minutes, we'll get to the O.J. Simpson saga, but let's continue our conversation about the Human Rights Watch report that deals with laws intended to protect people from sex offenders. But how does the law define a sex offense? Elizabeth Letourneau is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, and she's kind enough to join us today from the ARP studio in that city. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
Under the law, who has to register as a sex offender?
It varies by state, as Sarah was mentioning. In South Carolina, where I conduct my research on the impact of registration and notification laws on juvenile sex offenders, there are children with voyeurism convictions who are required to register. There are children
peeping
and
toms,
adults.
You mean?
Peeping toms, yes.
Yeah.
Hands-off sex crimes such as peeping tom or exhibitionism are registrable offenses in South Carolina, and will become registrable offenses when the Adam Walsh registration and notification policies that were enacted last year nationally go into effect.
In 2009, as I understand it.
By 2009, states can put those changes into effect now. And that one of the main changes of that federal legislation is to require and compel states to register children as young as 14. Many states register children younger. In South Carolina, for example, there's no lower age limit, although they try to keep children under the age of 12 off of our lifetime sex offender registry.
And are these registries limited to people involved in incidents or crimes related to children under the age of 18, or would a rapist of an adult woman, would they be on the list too?
Yes, rapists would be on the list, as they should if a law is going to target sex offending. But the focus is certainly on offenders whose victims were younger, and that is another way in which these policies really unfairly target juveniles, because, of course, their victims tend to be younger because they are younger. And many states fail to make any distinction between a 45-year-old who has sex with a 13-year-old and an 11 or 12 or 13-year-old who has sex with a 13-year-old, or even a younger child. There seems to be this idea that if you have sex with a child, regardless of your age, you must be a pedophile and you must be at high risk for reoffending require a high degree of supervision. And that's simply not the case for many sex offenders, and it is especially not the case for juvenile sex offenders.
And is it the case, in your experience, as Sarah Tofte was telling us earlier, that the great majority, the vast majority of offenses against children are by people they know and love and trust?
Yes, there's very clear research from every country that conducts research on sex offenders that shows that the great majority, 80-90% of sex offenses are committed by someone who the victim knew and knew well.
Can sex offenders be rehabilitated?
Indeed, they can. And to suggest that all sex offenders can't is sort of illogical. Sex offenders can be rehabilitated. There's actually good evidence from randomized clinical trials about how to best intervene with juvenile sex offenders. The evidence for adult sex offenders is not quite as sophisticated, but it is it certainly does indicate that many individuals can be rehabilitated. Many want to be rehabilitated. Once they're caught, they're ashamed of themselves, and or they just want to stay out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, of course, sex offenders can be rehabilitated. Some cannot. There are some offenders who are at very high risk for reoffending, sex offenders who have a high level of psychopathy. They have no empathy for others, no respect for the rights of others. And sex offenders with high levels of deviant sexual arousal, adult offenders who are primarily aroused to children, those individuals are at higher risk for recidivism, and they deserve a higher level of scrutiny and a different type, probably, of treatment or intervention than most sex offenders.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Jen. Jen's calling us from Keene in New Hampshire.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two little kids, and I have a nephew who was at 17 at the time who got caught feeling up my kids. And because it was family and because he was underage, nothing came of it. But I'll tell you what, I wish his name was on this list, and I don't want to see it come off, because contrary to what she's saying about recidivism rates, it's been my experience, and I have a degree in sociology. I studied this stuff pretty thoroughly at one point. Most people who have poor impulse control don't all of a sudden get impulse control because they went to treatments or they went to therapy. This isn't something to take chances with. These are kids. We're not talking about, you know, adults who are doing date rape necessarily. When we're talking about kids being molested, I'd just as soon see the offender's name on the list for the rest of their lives and hope that nobody else's kids get put where mine were.
Elizabeth Letourneau, I wonder if you have a response to that.
Well, I want to respond on two levels. I also have a young child, and I would hate for anything to ever happen to him, and so I can certainly feel for this mom whose children were molested by a 17-year-old cousin, and it is an absolute shame that nothing was done. That child should have been treated, absolutely. But people who are impulsive actually do get unimpulsive. There is kind of adolescence-limited impulsivity. Adolescents are known to have their brains are wired such that they focus on the short term more than adults do. They fail to focus on the long term. It's been proposed that the defense of not guilty by reason of adolescence should be a reasonable defense. That most juvenile offending, whether it's sexual offending or otherwise, is limited to adolescence. This is something that they grow out of, and so placing a 17-year-old's name on a registry for the rest of his life might engender some more positive feelings for the mom whose children were molested, but it's unlikely to benefit the rest of society, given that if this kid had been treated, he probably would not, very likely would not go on to reoffend. And so with his name on the registry for the rest of his life, he's also not going
to be able to get a job.
Do
you understand Jen's point? Very likely sometimes is not enough reassurance.
No, and unfortunately, we can't say never. I mean, it was reassuring that the person who has the online sex offender registry acknowledged that some people don't belong on them, because many people don't. Many people feel that, you know, once you've offended, you're always going to be an offender and you're always going to be at risk. And nobody can – there's no amount of testing, you know, that could make me say this person will never, ever in his life reoffend. Mm-hmm. But given that most sex offenses are committed by first-time offenders, given that the vast majority of adolescent sex offenders and even the majority of adult sex offenders do not go on to reoffend, I think we do need some much more targeted, specific laws that really target the higher risk offenders and that don't ruin the chances of low-risk offenders for successfully reintegrating into society. I mean, there are, you know, there's children as young as 12 on South Carolina's lifetime sex offender registry. They're not going to be able to stay at their schools probably. They have to move. I know of cases where families have moved out of state to try to get a better situation for their children after they've successfully completed years of treatment and lived offense-free.
Jen, I suspect you're unconvinced. Are you still there? I think Jen has left us. Anyway, we thank her for her call. And Elizabeth Letourneau, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Elizabeth Letourneau is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. She joins us today from the ARP studio in that city. O.J. Simpson coming up next. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.